Today, our speaker is Michael Bone, and Mike is a plant propagator at the Denver Botanic Gardens. He's also the curator of the STEP collection. The STEP is what Panayoti talked about in his talk on the 22nd of March. You probably recall we've been kind of weaving information about the STEP all the way through this series so far based on that talk. So I'm sure Mike will have a lot more to add about STEP and how it relates to us here in the Interior West. Mike has focused his work on seed collection and the study of STEP plants and ecology. Most of his work has been done in Western North America, but he's also traveled to Central Asia to study plants from the steppes and mountains there. Mike's also actively involved in the Plant Select program, which we'll be hearing about more from its director, Pat Hayward, in another, I think next week actually. And Mike is involved in the IPPS, the International Plant Propagators Society. So to sum it up, Mike is a great guy to tell us about how to successfully get plants to grow here in the Interior Western Steppe. So with that, Mike, how are you this morning?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for having me be a part of this series and get to talk to you.
You're very welcome. We're delighted to have you. So I'm just going to start at the point we started with most of our speakers and ask you how you first started gardening and where that was.
It was a little bit of a roundabout for me. When I was in my preteens and through my early teenage years, I would go to the panhandle of Texas to help my grandfather on his farm during summers. And that sort of gave me this sort of a little bit of a passion for being outside and having your hands in the dirt and, you know, that sense of work ethic that you kind of only get on a farm. After that, I really, you know, I've always enjoyed camping and being outside and hiking and that kind of thing, but I didn't really come to gardening until, again, sort of in my early 20s, I had a sort of a career shift from being a union machinist into working for a landscape company in and around their greenhouses. And that kind of was a big spark for me, seeing sort of this combination of machine and nature coming together to produce and grow, you know, these amazing flowers from annuals to perennials to everything. And that sort of sparked my imagination and my passion for what I do, and it's sort of grown from there. My first actual garden wasn't until I moved into my first home and started developing native and dryland gardens there, just to sort of fuel my own study and interest in the natural world and collecting seeds and what to do with them and how to get them to germinate. They always seem so mysterious, and it's, to me, it's always been like solving a puzzle. And then once I've solved that puzzle, I need to do something with the plants. So that's kind of where my gardening obsession has started.
Yeah, that's great. And excuse me, I can definitely relate to the kind of mystery of germinating the seeds and starting from that point, because I'll admit I think it's a very difficult proposition here in this climate with our conditions. And that's one of the reasons I'm very excited to bring you in to the fold here and help or have you help us all to see it as something much easier and all the good reasons to do it. So will you tell us, Mike, about the elevation where you garden now at your home and what your native soil is like?
Yeah, I'm actually very lucky right now. We've moved, my first garden and home was in just north of Denver in Thornton, in just sort of one of those little postage stamp 60 by 90 lots with a small house on it. And that garden quickly filled up, and I would just sort of go out to the garden and stare ugly at things and hope they would die so I'd have room for new things to plant. But 3 years ago, my wife and I moved to an old farmhouse in Arvada, which is just west of town, And it was one of the original farmhouses for the area. So the soil there was amended and taken care of and manured and composted, and sort of over years became that sort of mythical chocolate cake soil that you hear about in the Midwest. And I'm on a half an acre, and one of the first things I did was build sort of a little dryland step rock garden in the front, and then started construction on my little home greenhouse, which we just completed before winter set on last year, so I've had a good luck starting a lot of my seeds and things at home in my personal greenhouse. I grow a lot of stuff for my vegetable garden. In our new house, we have about 1,000-square-foot vegetable garden, and we're running off of a shallow irrigation well, so I have access to some water, but I try to reserve and save the water for things that need it more, vegetables, and most of the plants that sort of pick my obsession or my fascination are the dryland things who don't want the irrigation. So I'm kind of one of the lucky people who has a great source of water but doesn't need to use it.
Yeah, and that great soil, and it sounds like your interest in plants might be just as happy in some, pardon the term, but terrible soil.
Yeah. And you know, so, I mean, terrible soil can be a bit of a relative term. You know, if you're trying to grow cactus and dryland plants, a terrible soil would be something that's really rich in organic matter that holds a lot of water and holds too much nutrition. So I find myself having to unamend a lot of my garden soils with grit and with sand and with more mineral-based soils to mediate too much of a good thing for farming and vegetable soils that the ground was sort of used to. So it's kind of funny. We're always looking for something different than we have, maybe.
Exactly. That is funny. So if you were to plant some of the dryland plants in your chocolate cake soil, tell us what would happen.
Well, a lot of what happens is it just retains too much moisture. You know, a lot of these plants that grow in these dryland or these disturbed sites are just so dependent on higher levels of oxygen than you have in these sort of thicker, and I say heavy, but that's sort of an incorrect term, but these thicker, richer, maybe organic filled soils. These dryland and these native plants have spent a long time adapting to the fact that they don't have that. So once they're given it, they shun away from it. So you see things like burning like too much nutrition, so it creates too soft of growth. So sometimes you can lose hardiness because the plants are actually too soft growing in some of these overly rich and amended soils. You see that they tend to stay too wet. Again, that organic matter will hold on to a lot more of that water. It won't let it sort of flush and run through. I almost sometimes think of dryland gardening and gardening with dryland native plants a little bit along the lines of like a hydroponic setup. You know, when there's not water running through sort of these hydroponic cubes or whatever, there's just, it's pure oxygen and it's a chance for all of those roots to respire. And then they get their little flush of water and then they're back to having nice opportunities and access to oxygen, which I think is one of the things that we really, for gardeners in the West, is sort of that hard mental shift, you know, because we think we have to add so much when it, at some point it starts to take away from our ability to grow some of the choicest and the coolest things.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And to bring it to a place where many of the listeners may have experienced with just some really common plants that are growing throughout the West, I see catmint and Russian sage. When they look miserable, a lot of times they'll overgrow themselves and splay open in the middle and just look bad. And a lot of times it's because the soil is too rich, too amended, too much water, and they do kind of literally overgrow themselves, and it shortens their lifespan because it just puts out so much more energy than they need to look good that they burn up their reserves and they don't live as long. So, yeah, there's all kinds of reasons we don't want to do that, and we'll be glad to learn more about that from you through this call. And so, Mike, where were you introduced to the methods that you use now? It sounds like a lot of trial and error. Was some of it in schooling, or once you got to your current post at the Botanic Gardens?
I'm a big believer that, you know, failure is oftentimes, I know, my best teacher. But I did attend Front Range Community College, and I have a 2-year degree from Front Range. I studied under Ray Doherty, who is the head of the program there, who was one of my very first mentors in horticulture, and really helped instill in me a lot of the ideas and the creativity of finding solutions to problems that people don't really think of. So I studied at Front Range Community College, and then a lot of it has just been personal sort of obsession and need to study. And I get a lot of that information from the International Plant Propagators Society, which is a professional society that brings together propagators and producers from around the world and gives them an opportunity to exchange ideas, to tour nurseries, to sort of see and exchange in ways that you often don't think of when you're, you know, sort of trapped in your own greenhouse. It's hard to think outside of your greenhouse walls. But once you get to connect with another group of people who share that interest and passion, it's a great exchange of ideas. So that's been a big teaching or learning resource for me, as well as some of the more traditional learning at the Front Range Community College. And then a lot of it is just work. One of the interesting things you find in plant production is you sort of have usually only one chance to figure something out for that year. And then you have to take, you know, rigorous notes, and you have to remember until the next year exactly what you did and what you want to try to change. And there's so many variables involved that you really have to sort of pull everything apart and inspect your systems, inspect everything from the soils that you use to the fertilizers to the light to the time of day to all of those things really weigh in when you are producing a plant in containers or to be moved somewhere else. So you kind of have that one chance, and if you don't do some research ahead of time to set yourself up with a good situation, then you have to wait until next year to sort of try again. So I've always taken that stance that if you do a little bit of research and back study on growing some of these things, you'll know where they come from, some of their habits, some of their patterns, and that gives you clues going forward as to how to them and take care of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. So research is helpful. Note-taking is helpful. I always encourage people to keep a garden journal. I think for what all of us do as gardeners, it is very helpful because it's kind of the same thing as what you're saying. You have one chance for the year to take down all of those notes about what you're doing and get all that information that you're going to need next year, because most of us are not going to remember all those details for all the different factors and plants we're growing in our gardens the next year. So I think that's a really valuable method that all of us can employ. And yours just sounds a lot more tedious than probably most of us need to have.
Not necessarily. And I am a kind of a big book nerd and research nerd as well. And, you know, that sort of fills the long, cold winter hours as my dreams for the the coming growing season, and you know, reading and researching and obsessing about these plants that you know you read in books or travel logs, or you hear your friends or colleagues speak about, or you know, I enjoy a lot of the presentations from the cactus societies and the Rocky Alpine Garden societies. You know, they bring in these speakers who've taken these amazing trips around the world and studied these plants, and so I've sort of fill my mental coffers with ideas and of places that have these similar conditions to where we grow, and I start researching and studying those plants and figuring out new ways to grow them or ways to get them in. Because taking something from a wild place to a cultivated place is an interesting prospect, and there's a lot of things to consider when you do that kind of work. But yeah, I like, I guess part of it maybe that background in, you know, in machinery where everything is just, you know, so, and it's very detail-oriented work, but I guess that fulfills some sort of psychological need in me doing that kind of work.
Well, yeah, it helps when you love it, and it's obvious that you do, and it certainly makes it more fun. So that's great, and I think that's why we're all here, because we do love it, gardening in general. So, Mike, will you tell us about seed growing and why we should care about it? What are the advantages?
Well, seeds, firstly, are, to me, one of the most fascinating outcomes of the life cycle of a plant. It is typically a plant's only way to move somewhere else, to either better or worsen its situation. And it is sort of this little packet of infinite possibilities as far as what you can do for your garden, as far as variability, and it can be a real challenge, or again, you know, I think I mentioned earlier, sort of solving the puzzle of seed germination is a really, to me, a really fascinating thing. I'd rather work on a seed puzzle than a Sudoku or a crossword puzzle. But seeds really give you an opportunity to effectively and efficiently and sort of cost-effectively create new spaces and create new plants. It's a great way to save things from year to year, to find out what works, to save the seeds, to clean them. To me, working with and saving seeds and growing seeds and germinating seeds sort of really completes that whole circle and cycle of life, from germination to growing to mature flowering to completing the cycle and producing a new crop of seed, with the promise of new growth for the coming year. And there's something very beautiful about how every seed of every plant is different, and they all have sort of these different mechanisms. And when you think about where they come from and the sort of the logical nature of their specific situation, a lot of times the clues that the environment and the habitats come up with are amazing clues on how these plants will grow and work, and how you can germinate them and how you can grow them. So seeds are one, a great thing, because they're probably the cheapest way to get plants, and there's a lot of sense of accomplishment in germinating it, growing it, planting it, and watching it mature. Even if it's as simple as a broccoli plant, or as, you know, sort of complicated as some of our trees and shrubs and some of the rare or more unusual perennials that will live for years and years. And working with seeds, too, gives you the opportunity, if you're ever very interested in breeding work or, you know, seeking out new color forms, that's where all of that sort of comes from. That's where all of the new cultivars, all the new variabilities, all of the new colors, the strains, all come from breeding and cross-pollination work. So the variability that comes from seeds, to me, is fascinating as well. And then also there's the opportunity to create and maintain your own sort of seed strains. You find a population of a plant that has a unique color form. You can bring that back in, you can isolate it, and you can replicate it, and you can keep things that can be true to type through seed. But seeds are also plants' best ways to combat climate change, to combat diseases, to combat pests. When people are looking for survival mechanisms, say, and this sort of an off-the-wall maybe example is with the Dutch elm disease. People are constantly looking for populations that have been destroyed by Dutch elm disease. They look for one or two anomalies within those populations. There'll be a elm tree that'll survive. Somewhere in that genetic code of that is an adaptation to be resistant to that disease. So people look to those kind of naturally occurring mutations and hybridizations to protect species. And that's how new species become, you know, sort of come into existence too, is there's a new pressure, evolutionary pressure, there's a new climactic pressure or something that forces that plant to change, and only the ones that become resistant to whatever that pressure is are the ones that survive. So sort of seeing some of those things work and nature and plant's ability to compensate for those changes is fascinating to me as well. And that can only happen through seeds.
Yeah, indeed. So seeds, to summarize, seeds open the door of all kinds of worlds of information and opportunity and adaptability. It sounds pretty amazing.
And it's sort of that only way that you'll ever, you know, get to imagine or recreate a part of another world. Some of the gardens I like to create little vignettes in my garden are places that I've traveled to. Even if I haven't collected the seeds there, you can buy seeds or, you know, exchange seeds with people through seed exchanges of areas that I've been to, and I like to try to recreate a little snapshot of that point and place in my life or that place that I was. You know, I have an area, I have a garden at home that is reflective of all plants of the Tian Shan Mountains and the Altai Mountains in Central Asia, where I've been fortunate enough to go to a couple of times. So I create these gardens of plants that are specifically there, and I try to recreate, in my mind, a snippet of the geology that was there so that the plants can, you know, sort of grow and look. And instead of looking through a picture book or something like that, I can look at a garden and relive sort of a piece of my life that was important to me through gardening. And to me, that's very exciting. I have a small garden that is reflective of the Pawnee Buttes National Grassland here in northeastern Colorado, one of my favorite places to go and explore in the short grass prairies and the steppes of Colorado. It's a very beautiful, an awe-inspiring place for me, so I create a small garden that has some of the grasses and the cactus and the wildflowers from that area and create a little vignette for that. And one of the best ways to do that is, you know, by growing seeds and letting them sort of, the plants move and decide how they want to recreate that space as well. Mm-hmm. Living pictures, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And you can find a much greater diversity of plant material by seeking out the seeds rather than buying the plants themselves, I've noticed. And I've also noticed that rock gardeners are amazing at what you're just describing, kind of having your own version of geobotany in your garden. And the first time I ever saw that was when I visited a woman's garden in Calgary, Canada, and she's a big part of the Rock Garden Society, and she had a whole section just for plants from the Czech Republic. And I just thought it was so fascinating. And so, yeah, it really helps to understand, I think, for me anyway, in concrete terms, what these plants have in common, what their growing conditions are. So your garden sounds like it would be fabulously interesting to visit, Mike. So I wanted to step back for a second and ask you something that I was curious about. You said something to the effect of the places where plants are from and the type of seeds they have give you information about how to grow them. Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, seeds and plants, sort of their job is to survive. And if you think of plants and their life cycles, I use, this is sort of my go-to example as far as decoding sort of complex germination problems. But when you think of it, it sort of starts to become logical and starts to become clear. So let me give an example. One of my favorite native woodland sort of montane shrubs is the Rubus deliciosus, which is the boulder raspberry that grows through the foothills and canyons here along the Front Range of Denver. And it's a beautiful little raspberry shrub with white flowers and beautiful red berries, and it attracts wildlife and pollinators, and it's a wonderful little plant, but it is notoriously tricky to grow and to germinate. The typical protocol for greenhouses or people who produce them by seed is you have to take the seeds and you soak it in sulfuric acid for 45 minutes, and then you take it out and you rinse it and you rub it clean, and then you put it in what I call a sweating bag. So it's a little bit of soil, moistened soil, and you put the seed in there and you put it in a hot greenhouse, and it's in a sealed plastic bag, and it just sort of has to sweat for a couple of weeks. And then you have to put it into a cooler for 45 days and let it have a cold stratification, and it has to freeze and be cold for a long period of time. And then you can take it out and put it into trays, and it will start to germinate. And then the ones that don't start to germinate, you then put back after 30 days of warm, moist greenhouse treatment, you put back into the cooler for another 45 days of cold. So it sounds like this long, sort of very tedious process, but if you step back and look at the plant and where it grows and what happens to it, you kind of figure that out. So the plant comes up and it blooms in sort of midsummer, late spring, and blooms throughout the season and produces these fruits. And these fruits are delicious to animals. One of the problems I've always had with Rubus deliciosus is that it's probably the worst tasting raspberry I've ever tasted. They're small and very bitter fruits. So I think the people who named that one missed the mark when they named that one. But bears and birds love this plant. And so the bears and the birds will eat the fruit of that, and then it has to travel through a digestive tract. So those seeds have had to develop this really intense seed coat to survive stomach acids. And then once they've survived the stomach acids, they're transplanted or planted out in this hot, moist fertilizer packet that is rich and hot and sort of decaying and decomposing. So that sort of mirrors the sweating treatment or the hot, moist greenhouse treatment in the potting soil. And then as soon as that, the waste of that animal is cooled off, it's become winter. And then that plant has to be able to survive winter before it'll grow. So it has these chemical processes inside of it that need to be broken down that only happen at certain colder temperatures. Before that plant will germinate. So it has to survive and program itself not to germinate in the middle of winter and not to germinate in the fall when the winter and the cold weather is coming on. So it has that cold requirement that it needs to fulfill before it realizes, hey, spring is coming. Okay, it's warmed up again. I've been through a cold period. Spring is here. I can now germinate and start to grow. But the fluctuations along the Front Range, we often have weird late season storms. You know, this year we've been very, very warm all through our spring, but there's still potential of very, very cold weather all the way up into the middle of May. We can still have hard freezes and hard frosts, which would destroy and kill young seedlings coming up. So some of the seeds are programmed to wait for yet even another cycle beyond that first one. If the first ones that germinate and come up and sort of get out of the gate and have a little bit of a head start, but that plant has produced enough seeds inside of one of those fruits that if that first crop or that first set of germinants don't survive, then there is still an opportunity for that plant to survive afterwards and survive our weird, freakish, you know, freak cold spells that come in the spring. So by looking at the plant and looking at the year and what that plant has to endure over the cycle of a year sort of gives you the clues to why you go through all of these steps to germinate these plants. So that's
right.
Kind of my classic initial example, but you see similar adaptations when you look at plants that come from areas that have natural fire cycles. Most of the North American steppe and the Great Plains are fire cycle areas where these quick sort of flash fires and flash burns come through, and it's completely normal. It's completely natural. So most of the seeds have adapted to have some sort of either really thickened or impervious seed coat that will only be eaten away or taken away at by long periods being in the ground and being attacked by microorganisms, or they'll get eaten through because they have to survive a fire cycle. So a lot of these plants need fire or some sort of makeshift fire or some method of getting through those hard seed coats to get them to germinate. That's one of the interesting things about North American steppes is that we are a fire cycle climate. One of the interesting things about sort of Central Asian steppe is that because of the ecology, because of weather patterns there, they have no natural fire cycle. So fire is a very devastating thing in that part of the world. And most seeds are not adapted to surviving those fire cycles. So they have other means or other mechanisms for long-term storage or disposal or movement, but surviving fire is not one of those. You see that in the respect that a lot of people doing noxious weed research, and some of our greatest weeds come from Central Asia, but a lot of times the mediating factor or the way you control these noxious weeds from Central Asia is through burning, because it promotes our natural vegetation to regenerate and to come back, and it kills off this vegetation that is not evolved or adapted to these fire cycles. So looking at some of those greater ecological patterns also gives you a clue into what you have to do to get some of these seeds to germinate.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I really like learning about the all the, how do I want to sum it up, the information that's out there and how incredible the seeds are. And I'm feeling inspired to want to try again to work with seeds, and I'm hoping a bunch of our listeners are too. So how do we go about growing the seeds if we are inspired and want to? And maybe you can start digging into that question with wildflower seeds, because as a garden consultant here in Southwest Colorado, that's one of the things I have people asking me about most often, is how do I get wildflower seeds on this whole embankment or this whole meadow they want to create or something. And I've found a lot of challenges with that from different angles, but I wonder what your take on that is.
Well, I tend to look at each seed or each plant as a unique case. To me, I personally don't do a lot with like just sort of these commercial wildflower mixes. And for me, terminology sometimes I think can be confusing too. So first I'll address the issue of wildflowers. And to me, any plant can be a wildflower because originally it comes from someplace wild. So to say that a plant is or is not a wildflower, or if it's in a greenhouse, then it's not a wildflower, or if it's, you know. So personally, and I guess maybe my path to gardening and what I do, I don't distinguish necessarily wildflowers from non-wildflowers. So that just being a bit of semantics on my end. So I'll go back to just talking about seeds and germinating them and maybe some things you can do to either create your own mixes of seeds to put out or what happens when you get some of these prepackaged wildflower mixtures. I'll start with prepackaged sort of wildflower mixtures. There's a lot of companies that sell them and do a pretty good job. But what happens, again, is they take sort of a snapshot of the plants that would grow naturally in an area. They collect the seeds of those, or they produce the seeds of those. They clean and sort and take care of them individually, and then they mix them in specific ratios. I say, you know, it's a tall grass prairie wildflower mix. They just sort of do a survey of flowering plants that show up in a tall grass prairie. They bring them in. They mix them together with 10% of these Liatris seeds and 50% of these Galardia seeds and 20% of these Achilleas, et cetera, et cetera. They put it together. You sprinkle it out there. 1 year you have a bunch of something come up. The next year something else will come up. Well, those plants are trying to follow their natural cycles. Some places that create these wildflower mixes will go in and actually do some pre-treatments to specific things. So say a delphinium needs a very specific cold requirement met before it can germinate. Sometimes the seed companies or the wildflower mix companies will prime or program, you use those two terms, they will pre-treat those seeds before they go into the mix so that they'll germinate. But if you're out and, you know, collecting your own wildflowers and you just sow them out there, it can be a little challenging or sometimes disheartening because you're throwing out maybe what you think is good quality viable seed. But I've found through my years of studying seeds that when I'm collecting seeds, most of what a plant produces is not viable seed. Plants spend a lot of energy producing things that look like seeds that don't have anything in them. So going back, commercial wildflower mixes, they have testing mechanisms, they sort out, and they provide what is a good seed. So seeds that you would collect are very different and kind of need to be treated or thought of a little bit differently from wildflower seeds that you may buy in. So shifting gears from bought wildflower mixes to sort of creating or working with your own wildflower mixes. I have some friends who live in mountain properties and they want to, you know, sort of bulk up their personal wildflower displays. So I've worked with them to, you know, collect and process and clean the seeds that are on their lands to look at getting some of the seeds. And then thinking about pre-programming your own seeds for your wildflower mixes to sow in situ. So some of the things you can do, I'm finding more and more research is going into this, and I'm having greater and greater success in treating seeds with hydrogen peroxide. And there's a lot of chemistry that goes behind why hydrogen peroxide is more and more important to seed germination, but I'm not going to go into the chemistry of that. But other than to say that it does two things. The hydrogen peroxide can be caustic and will eat away at tough seed coats, and hydrogen peroxide also has a physiological effect on the chemicals that are naturally occurring in the seed that will delay germination. So a couple of things you can do to sort of prime or create your own wildflower mix. If you've dry stored a lot of the seeds over the winter, cleaned them and processed and pulled out everything that looks to be sort of the best seeds, a great thing to do is just soak them for 4 to 6 hours in hydrogen peroxide. And just the, you know, 3% hydrogen peroxide that you get that you would pour on a cut or something like that. You use just that bottled hydrogen peroxide, soak it for 6 hours, and then you can spread the seed out where you want your flower mix to germinate and grow. Another thing that you can do to be sort of successful is sort of pre-program or pre-prime, I guess, your seeds through natural cold stratification. So you can create sort of your wildflower mix and put them in sort of long trays, or I've seen people use strips of paper that they'll glue them to strips of paper and put them down. But you want to give that sort of a natural cold cycle and cold stratification. So you can sow them in open trays and then leave them out for the winter. I like to, when I cold stratify trays out for the winter, especially if it's going to be a mix of things, you can sow them all in just some potting mix on a soil, wet it down, wrap it in a plastic trash bag or something. I typically will put them on the north side of a building or on the north side of a house that will stay cold and frozen longer. You do that in October, November, wrap it in plastic, put it on the sort of the north side to give it a natural cold stratification. And then about this time of year, March, April, unwrap the plastic, bring the plants out and put them, you know, even outside somewhere, start watering them and watching the seeds germinate. And then as the seeds germinate, if it's just a big mix of soil, you can either cut that up and plant out little pockets of the wildflowers to let them sort of grow and distribute themselves, or you can plant the little sort of trays in larger strips and just have sort of these. It looks a little funny when you start, so because you have these big rectangular swaths of wildflowers out there, but they start to move and naturalize and grow in with themselves. So those are kind of a couple of tricks you can do to get them out there and let them stratify. I think one of the things that maybe cause for some frustrations in people when they try to just sprinkle some seeds out in the garden and hope that something comes up. Seeds are a natural food source for insects and rodents and birds and all kinds of things that you may not see active and working in your garden when you just put these things out there. So sowing them in trays or putting them out there, you know, and sowing them in a springtime when things aren't foraging and looking for any seed they can to survive the winters can be a good thing. So I think I see a lot of people less successful in just sprinkling things onto a hillside and waiting and hoping for something to happen, where you can actually do some pre-treatments of your seeds with hydrogen peroxide, with natural cold stratification in trays that are protected and kept away from foraging animals, and then transplanting them out. I think you can have better success that way.
Great. Thank you. Good tips for sure. And I'm wondering if there might be some plants that need, well, I wouldn't think so here in our cold climate, but I'm going to ask anyway, are there plants that don't need any stratification, or ones that you might consider super easy for folks and easily accessible that do really well here?
Oh, absolutely. There's so seeds, oftentimes when you're talking to people in the seed world, there's sort of there's a bunch of different ways to classify everything. But most seeds will fall into one of these two types of classifications of either being orthodox seed or recalcitrant seeds. And orthodox seeds just simply means they're seeds that tolerate or require dry storage. So oftentimes those are the ones that will be the most complicated when you're working with orthodox seeds. Recalcitrant seeds are seeds that typically do not tolerate dry storage. That's sort of the basic delineating factor between orthodox and recalcitrant. Is recalcitrant seeds, if you let the seeds dry out or you try to store them for an extended period of time, the embryos inside sort of wither and die and the seed is no longer viable. So those are the ones, those are the seeds that germinate right away, or they come up and they're typically the easiest. And the main classes or the main types of plants that will produce recalcitrant seeds are things that will bloom and set seed very early in the spring. So even, you know, some of these plants that grow, as the snow is receding, they're already up and blooming. So sometimes they're alpines, or they're these plants that chase the snowbanks back. But early fruiting, early flowering seeds, because those seeds will then germinate, they'll hit its spring runoff, and they capitalize on that, and then they capitalize on having a full growing season before winter comes in. So plants that set their seeds early in spring are typically very easy to germinate, very easy to grow, and very easy to produce.
Can you drop some names for us?
Oh, yes. Lilacs, a lot of our alpines that do that, so members of the ranunculus family. There's even some of our very early season asters, like the Townsendias, the pasque flowers. Pasque flowers are in the Ranunculaceae family, so the, you know, the pulsatillas that you see that are blooming now all across the Front Range, you collect those seeds green and get them sowing right away, and they'll germinate and grow for you better than trying to store and save them to plant the following year. So those are a few of those. Other plants that are typically recalcitrant are tropical plants, just because they don't have these dry, cold periods that they have to survive. A tropical plant has to germinate and start trying to outcompete everything around it right away. Other plants that are recalcitrant are plants from wetlands or riparian areas, because again, they don't have to have those long periods of dry storage, and if they don't germinate and start growing right away, they lose out on their chance to grow. So wetland species, a lot of the grasses from wetland areas, the Vernonias are good examples of those. So these things, you see marginals growing there along sides of rivers, typically will be recalcitrant. And then the last sort of major class of plants that produce recalcitrant seeds are the nut crops. So things like oaks, the juglans, so those are the walnuts. Any of those nut crops that have an oil surrounding the embryo, once that oil dries out, the embryo inside also dries out. So what you see when oaks germinate is they'll typically fall off, they'll hit the ground, and even within a day or two, that radical will emerge. It'll pull that acorn down into the ground, and it'll set that taproot, and that taproot will allow that plant to survive the winter. Also, oaks exhibit hypogeal type of germination, where the cotyledons never actually come out of that acorn. Those cotyledons are just sort of a storage device that helps feed that root for the winter until the next spring comes, and then the plant starts growing the stem and immediately has sort of mature leaves. So you typically will never see cotyledons up and growing on an oak tree because they're recalcitrant. You know, they come down, they germinate right away in the fall, and they set that taproot to survive the winter. So those are kind of some of the things that are recalcitrant. Also, one of the things that are really successful and really easy to do are desert annuals, or these ephemeral annuals. We've got a lot of beautiful Western native annuals. One of my favorites comes from Utah and California, Arizona. It's Phacelia campanulata, and this is electric blue bells on these reseeding plants that just thrive in disturbed soils and the worst spots. I've sprinkled them into a lot of my cactus containers. My cactus will be there, and these incredible blue, electric blue flowers will just seed all around my cactus pots and just be completely happy without water or without irrigation. So they're these plants that come from these ephemeral sort of deserts that, you know, they only get a very little bit of precipitation in a year, if any, or they'll get, you know, they'll be on these 50-year cycles where, you know, you hear the deserts in bloom. Well, there's a weather pattern that came through and has germinated and growing all of these desert annuals. And we have some beautiful ones around. So the Claytonias, a lot of those are wonderful desert annuals for us. There's a lot of species of lupin that make wonderful annuals and that germinate and grow and do very well for us. So those are some of the types of plants that will do well for you, just germinating quickly. And it's fun to have things that you can be successful with right away to inspire you to try harder and harder things.
Definitely true, for sure. So the Cecilia campanulata, is that, did I get the name right, with the electric blue flowers?
Yes.
You described? And is that one, where would we have to go to find that plant? A seed exchange, or do you know if it's commercially available?
It is commercially available. I know here in Denver, just north of Denver, there's a seed company that packages and sells it. There's a couple local companies. I believe it's Beauty Beyond Belief sells that. So if there's places that sell that, that line would have it. Also, Botanical Interests is another Colorado company that I believe has those available, and other plants of that nature. So those are a couple of companies to look for. Maybe you don't have access to a independently owned garden center that might carry those. You can find them and order them on the web pretty easily.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, you sold me on that one. It sounds amazing. So I want to ask one more question. I say that and then I often find another one. But anyway, one more question as of now, and then we'll move towards wrapping up the call. One thing that I don't think I've heard you mention that I have always kind of thought of as a great reason to grow plants from seed is the better establishment rates as well as more hardiness. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, being that, you know, I produce plants from cuttings, also here at the Botanic Gardens we have a micropropagation or a tissue culture lab. I don't know that I see plants that are grown from, say, cuttings versus seeds to have sort of different establishment rates. I think maybe where I notice plants that maybe are seeded or grown into place versus being transplanted or moved is sometimes in like trees where, you know, and that's a little bit of a skewed thing. So I don't necessarily notice plants grown from seed establishing better than other ones. I think
I should clarify real quick.
You may get a natural. Yeah, I don't know. I've not had that experience.
It's a nursery pot, because that's what most of the people I know who garden or are casual gardeners are going to be buying plants from the nursery. It's either that or seed, probably more so than cuttings. And just with, I had meant to get to this, and maybe we can touch on it right now, as far as the whole, how different the soil is in nursery containers versus the native soil. And so looking at that comparison of planting that, a plant like that, into our native soil versus growing that same plant from seed.
Right, and a lot of that is, yeah, it goes back to the dynamics of, or the differences in just having something in a container and making it mobile as a living plant. Because, you know, I mean, plants, once they've germinated and rooted and growing, won't ever move themselves. Whereas if we don't want a plant to grow where it's at, we dig it up and move it. Or if we want it to start something earlier, you know, we germinate it in a greenhouse. So growing plants in a container, and one of the major reasons you use different soils in a container, is it has a lot to do with that oxygen and water movement through that container. Plants in the ground respond very differently to watering than a pot in a container. You know, that container is a limited volume. You have to overcome things like perched water tables. You're typically using something very lightweight so you can pick it up and move it. Sometimes, you know, trying to germinate and grow in our native soils, putting those into a container is very, very difficult, because you you change the dynamics of how water moves through there. So I would agree that there are times that sowing something in a garden and cultivating it like that in the ground, you can get a bit of a jump start because you don't have to wait for that transition of plant to establish, going from a containerized plant into planting in the garden. And you do want to be careful of going from these fluffy, rich, controlled soils that are typically used in containers and going into sort of a harsh bed. You do get what's called that soil interface that creates this barrier between these mineral soils and that sort of fluffy, perfect, engineered soil that you often see in these containers. So some of the things you can do to mediate that, and a lot of it, I think, is the way people plant plants from containers. A lot of people will just dig a hole, stuff it in there, and pack everything around that plant as tightly as they can, thinking that by compacting and pressing in the soil very tightly around that, that they've secured this soil to this root to soil sort of combination, and that they're going to be okay. One of the things I'll do when I plant something is I take it out and I sort of, depending on how rooted it is or how pot bound the roots are, sometimes I'll score the roots before I plant it, but I always dig a much larger hole than I would than is the size of the container, 2, 3, 4 times as large. And I really turn and try to oxygenate and leave that soil as fluffy and as loose as possible. And then I plant the container, you know, and if you can shake off any of the potting soil that it comes in the container, if you can easily shake that away without doing a lot of damage and stress to the plant, you can get rid of some of that. But then I put it in the planting hole and very sort of loosely backfill. I think by compacting that soil around there, you're creating a compacted layer of soil around this perfect soil, where if you loose fill back around it, you leave plenty of oxygen space, plenty of root space for the plants to send out new roots. That's a good thing. And then I always try to leave a little bit of a water well. So I use water when I'm planting. I use water as that factor that brings the roots and the soil in contact with each other. You know, rather than trying to push and force them together with your hands or, you know, stomping on it with your feet when you plant a tree. I've seen so many people do that. You use water to... Water has that gravity. When it goes into the ground, it pulls the particles together and it pulls everything in and you get good root-to-shoot contact without having to press and compact the soil around it. So leaving the soil light and fluffy as much as possible around your transplanted plants is a good thing. And then creating sort of a water well or a reservoir, even on 1 gallon or 2 1/4 inch perennials that I plant, I always leave, you know, I think maybe people have seen this when you plant trees, you know, there's always sort of this large ring around the root ball of the tree that they just flood and fill with water. I do that even on little 2 1/4 inch plants and perennials that I plant. I leave a small ring that I can have that reservoir of water. Because as you transplant it, getting water and oxygen to those little plants is pretty crucial. And planting earlier. I think people are always afraid of, especially with perennials, of planting, you know, too early, or they go and pull these plants that are out of these hot houses, and you know, they wait until June when we're getting into our harvest and they don't give the plants to establish. If you give a plant a chance to be potted and planted into the ground while it's still cool outside, that plant is going to have a much longer season to establish. It's going to establish through our cool, wet seasons before it has to try to survive the heat and misery of summer. So most of my perennial plantings are done in March and April, as soon as I'm able to get in and work the soil. So those are a couple of things. that you can do. And even when you're planting seeds, to give the seeds a good chance at root, you dig pretty deeply and you create oxygen there. Even if the seeds have to be sown at the surface of the soil, I always turn and fluff up and create as much oxygen space for little seeds to germinate in as possible.
So when we're refilling the hole when we plant the plant, it sounds like we really don't need to be worried about air pockets in there, because I had heard at some point or another that you don't want the roots in contact with a bunch of air rather than soil. You wanted the soil up against the roots. It sounds like that's sort of a myth then.
Well, I think you that sort of old guidelines are not necessarily based on dryland plants or plants that need and require that much oxygen. You know, if you think about what roots truly need, is the number one thing they need is oxygen. And by packing that in real tightly, you lose their access to oxygen. That's why when you think about, you know, or you look at plants that grow in these cactus mixes, or you talk to people who plant these, you know, crevice gardens, or they grow these more unusual things, they are looking towards creating what they call perfect drainage, or they're creating more pore spaces, or they're putting these aggregates in there that give them more air space. Now, large air pockets, you know, like the size of a cantaloupe or something around your plant that has no soil around it, won't do your plant any good, but lots of air spaces and lots of pockets and opportunities for those roots to get oxygen is a wonderful thing. So you don't necessarily want to just leave it out there and leave the roots exposed to, you know, open air and sunlight. That's very different from having a very loose mix and a very loose fill around the plant. So there's two very different things. But yes, you want oxygen, you want pore space, you want openings for those plants to have a chance to breathe, especially going from really fluffy mixes from a container into a soil.
And when you say you dig a much bigger hole than the pot, is that in width as well as depth?
Yes. And when you dig deeper, the one thing you have to be careful of is that, you know, I dig deeper, but then I backfill so that the plant is still planted at the sort of appropriate depth. You know, you don't want to bury the crown, especially on dryland plants. They're very sensitive to where the crown of that plant is. So even though I dig the hole much deeper, I then come back in and break up the clumps and fill the bottom of that hole with that loose material and then plant the plant sitting on top of, you know, a bottom bed of loose, disturbed soil, and then I lightly fill in around the sides, making sure that the crown is planted at the appropriate level, and that underneath and around all sides of it, it's been loose-filled with a nice sort of well-disturbed, oxygenated soil.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And do you find it important to spread the roots apart and to get rid of a lot of that soil they came in from the nursery?
Some of it's a little bit of case by case. Like if I have a pot that I've pulled out that is really, really pot bound, I mean, there's no more room for roots to grow and they're growing over the top of each other, I will create some wounds along there before I plant it. If I pull something out of the container and it has a good, healthy root system and a lot of that potting soil will just sort of fall away from it, I'll get rid of that potting soil and sort of lay out the roots. But if it's sort of, you know, I think we've all pulled plants out of containers and it's just sort of like this mold mirror image of the inside of the container has that exact same shape and it's really dense and tight. I think it's at that point it is really important to either score those roots or to flay them open and put them out. So I guess long story short, yes, that does help to flay the roots out and to disturb them and get them planted neatly. And that also, by removing some of that soil and putting them into that natural soil, you minimize that interface between the potting soil and the new natural soils or amended soils that you're going into in your garden.
Great. Well, Mike, I'm going to thank you for opening up our vision to a whole new world out there for some of us with seeds and some tips on how to grow our plants and transition them from the nursery into our gardens. I really appreciate your time and your information. Thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.